You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I teach government, history, and philosophy in Southwest Missouri. Joining me on the show is Dr. Nathan Gilmore, an English teacher at North Gwinnett High School. Nathan, how are you doing?
I am doing well, Coyle. We have not recorded in a while, and that is largely because my schedule, at least, just got more hectic than I could keep up with, so a couple things had to drop, and unfortunately this is one of them. I'm excited to be back on the microphone, though.
Well, I mean, our last episode went live in November of 2024. Good news is there's nothing of political interest that's happened since then, so it's been a good time to take a break, right?
It really has. Kind of a slow news, you know.
Yeah, definitely not new news every 30 seconds. Some things, however, obviously this is a very different world than it was in November of 2024, but some things haven't changed. We're still not recording video and posting it on YouTube, even though basically every other podcast is doing that. Is there any particular reason other than my camera isn't working right now?
You know, honestly, I just never really had a desire to be a YouTuber. So, you know, if sometime you want to try that out, you know, I'm not philosophically against it. It's just, you know, when I started podcasting in 9, it was an audio format. So I've just kind of stuck with that.
Yeah, I have no desire whatsoever to be on YouTube. As much as I would love to introduce us as content creators, Coyle Neal and Nathan Gilmore, I don't think we're quite there yet. We also still don't run ads or have sponsors. And I will admit, I'm a little disappointed. There's a part of me that would love to give a spot for, you know, Danny Anderson's at-home human taxidermy kit or something like that. We're just, we haven't done the ad thing yet. And again, is that no one's offering or we just choose not to?
Danny, if you're listening out there, you know, give us an email. We can work out terms. I will say that the Christian Humanist Radio Network is, I won't say that it is dead, but it's certainly in a slow stretch. There are still occasional episodes of before they were live. I'm trying to think. I think their last episode was on Zootopia 2, which I haven't actually seen, so I haven't listened to that episode. I also want to note that Michael Farmer of the Christian Humanist Radio Network has a new podcast over on Front Porch Republic called Symposium of Popular Songs. And Coyle, I'm going to go ahead and admit that I've not listened to any episodes of it yet because you have to download a special player to listen to it. And every time I think about downloading that special player, I'm usually driving somewhere.
That does not surprise me about Front Porch Republic at all. That very much tracks with them, that they have their own thing that you have to use.
So, but listeners, you know, our plan right now is to start off, you know, kind of at a measured pace as we revive City of Man, do an episode a month as kind of our, you know, baseline. And then if there are episodes that we decide we want to record at a faster clip than that, then we will do that. Is there anything else, Coyle, around the network or on the show that we need to talk about before we get to today's matter?
No, I'm happy to jump into today's matter. And this was your pitch for an episode, and I thought it sounded like a good one, albeit one that's full of landmines. So why don't you tell us what we're talking about?
Yes, I'll start dancing in that minefield. So what's gotten me thinking recently is that, you know, in recent years, as is always the case, people in the public world have died. And, you know, some of the notable deaths in the political world have been Dick Cheney, Jesse Jackson, Bob Mueller. And, you know, the one that really kind of got me thinking on overdrive on this question, Charlie Kirk. Now, each one of those, you know, is in the political realm in a different capacity. Some obviously are in very prominent elected office. Some have been candidates for public office, and some, you know, really never have sought to be elected, but instead are commentators. But what they all have in common is that, you know, because they have all died here in the last 18 months, give or take, they've drawn public comment online and elsewhere. And so, you know, the oddity of it is that when Dick Cheney died, I would have figured there would have been just an utter blast of venom. But at least in my circles, the response was fairly subdued. You know, when Bob Mueller died, honestly, not someone I associate with elected office so much with, you know, public service, you know, as a special prosecutor and as, you know, the head of different executive branch bureaus. But when he died, he got utterly blasted by the current resident of the Oval Office. And speaking of the current resident of the Oval Office, when Jesse Jackson died, I would have figured there would have been just, again, a blast of venom. But before that blast of venom could begin, you got the president of the United States posting in praise of Jesse Jackson. So all three of those, you know, each one is weird in its own way. The one, though, that has occupied most of my attention, and this is largely because I teach high schoolers and, you know, I hear high schoolers talk to each other about public events and the ways that high schoolers talk about public events, is just the meanness that came out with the assassination of Charlie Kirk. You know, this is going to be one of the things that we talk about, but, you know, I don't know if I was raised this way or if I just picked it up atmospherically, but, you know, one of the things that, you know, I kind of take as a starting point for the way that I talk about people is that, you know, when someone has died, then I owe that person at least the respect of talking about them as a historical figure rather than continuing the fight. And, you know, even beyond that, I feel like I have some kind of obligation to say that to those people for whom this person was important, I am sorry for your loss. That kind of talk really didn't happen with the assassination of Charlie Kirk. And like I said, what I'm wondering is, to what extent am I romanticizing my own younger years? To what extent have things really changed? And, you know, when I have questions like that and when they have to do with politics, I want to talk to Coyle Neal about it. So, Coyle, I'm going to start out throwing things back all the way to Homer. And the Rhapsode, the narrator of, you know, Homer's poem, doesn't comment on it one way or the other, as the Rhapsode in the Iliad tends not to comment. But I think that as we hear the story of Achilles towards the end of the Iliad, we're supposed to disapprove when Achilles does terrible things to the dead body of Hector. Is there a reasoned case to be made for something about a respect for the dead, even that far back? Or is, I mean, am I Christianizing this beyond what I should? Do you see that in the ancient world? I mean, I should remind listeners that Coyle recently has published some matter about ancient thought. So this will be a good time, you know, Coyle, if you want to plug your book, great. If not, just talk a little bit about Homer.
I mean, if any of our listeners have an extra $200 laying around that they want to spend on my book, they are welcome to do so. Other than that, it's one of those that's a press that usually targets university libraries. Yeah, I mean, in terms of Achilles, obviously, at that point in the Iliad, he is still angry, right? The reason for the treatment of Hector's body is it's part of the wrath of Achilles, and you don't have a resolution to the wrath. So is the treatment inappropriate under that circumstance? I think that's a complex question. I'm trying to think back to our brief interlude when we were covering great literature, the canon on core curriculum, right, on the network. The episodes
yep,
we did
the name
on
of the show.
Iliad.
Yep.
Yeah. So the episodes we did on the Iliad, one of the things that I tried to emphasize is that you need in the Iliad, you need some kind of formal public declaration to bring something to a close, and Achilles hadn't gotten that yet. Achilles had not, up until that point, there'd been no restitution, there'd been no reconciliation, there'd been no sort of release of everything that he had suffered. So his anger just grows and grows and grows, and the dragging of Hector's body around the city of Troy, well, that's kind of the pinnacle of that. And then almost immediately afterwards, Hector's father Priam comes over, and then they meet, and you have the restoration. You have the vehicle that Achilles has, that Achilles is given to release his anger. So it might be, and to tie that into the modern world, and it might be that in our modern world, our vehicle for releasing our anger is just the internet. When you and I were growing up, there was no internet, right? Or at least there wasn't much of an internet. If you had a instant
that.
Thought, well, yeah. So functionally, there was no internet. So if somebody died publicly and you had a thought, so I remember when Richard Nixon died, and basically at that point, nobody was a fan of Richard Nixon, right? There was really nobody who was like, oh, what a great guy, and we're so glad he was president. That person didn't exist. But if you had the thought, I'm glad he's dead, what would happen is you would think it, and then if you actually said it publicly to anyone, you would have to say it to someone's face, and then you would usually be instantly reprimanded or feel some level of shame for saying, well, I'm glad X person is dead. Whether you knew him or not didn't matter that much. With the internet, you never get that reprimand, right? There's never that moment of, hey, maybe I should exercise some self-censorship here. In fact, you're actively rewarded if you say it and then people like or dislike, doesn't really matter. You're actively rewarded by the attention. So it's another right. another place where those internal filters are being broken down by the instant technology. That's my cranky old man response to that. Why is it that there is much more celebration of people after they die, a celebration of the death of people? Well, I think there's not that social punishment for it that we used to receive. In fact, it's the opposite. It is now rewarded in ways that it wasn't in the past.
Right.
You could make a living just celebrating people.
And that's why it's curious to me. And this really is a grumpy old man comment, Coyle, but that's why it was curious to me to hear high schoolers whom I teach, you know, celebrating it in person. So, I mean, you know, it might just be because they were in circles of people where there was no reprimand like you were talking about. But even with that, you know, the absence of that reprimand, even when one was talking about one's opponents or enemies, just struck me as something new. Is it new, or am I, again, am I romanticizing too much?
No, I mean, it's not that I never would have heard of someone celebrating the death of someone else. And again, back in the early days of the Iraq War, I remember seeing Bob Dole go on one of the late night shows, and they asked, you know, the host, whoever it was, asked Bob Dole, you know, do you want to see Saddam Hussein killed? And his reply was, well, I fought in World War II. He had a withered arm. He said, I was injured in World War II. I never celebrate war. I will never say, I hope that guy gets killed. But, you know, if he slips and falls and bumps his head in the bathtub, so be it. Right. Even then, there's a sort of wrapping it in some sort of softening it up. So you're not just saying, I hope he dies. I'm glad he's dead. Even though he was, you know, the worst living dictator at the time.
Right,
so, yeah, I don't
think
you're romanticizing. I think we live in a very different world. And that's, as much as I hate to apply a monocause, if it's not entirely because of the internet and technology, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's kind of what I wondered. I mean, if, you know, people who don't remember a time before social media would be formed so differently from the way that I was, that this is simply normal. It's not something to be concerned about. It's just the way that people talk now.
Yeah, it might very well be. It might just be, it might be the new world. I mean, it is, right? It obviously is the new world we live in. I don't know how much of it, and here's where I live in my sort of small rural red state bubble. I don't know how much of that is translated into in-person conversation. You might have groups of people who agree with each other, but if you were to mix people who disagree in, would you still have that, right? Would you still have people actively celebrating if they know there are people in the room who are, you know, genuinely troubled by the death of someone? So you know, if you had burst into tears over the death of Charlie Kirk in front of your students, would they still have been actively celebrating it? Well, I don't know, right? I mean, that's a more complex question. I just don't know the answer to that.
Right. And it just now occurred to me, and I should have written this into the show notes because I don't even remember the person's name, but similar conversations happened when the insurance executive was assassinated. I can't remember his name, but with that one as well, I kept quiet because they're just hanging out in my classroom before school and I was doing some grading. So I didn't want to jump into the conversation because I needed to get some grading done. But that one struck me odd as well, that people would talk, you know, as openly as they were talking about, celebrating an assassination. So that's actually a pair of them where the celebration happened. And yet, and I'd like to hear you on this too. I mean, you know, and yet when Dick Cheney died, there was very little celebration going on about that one. Now with Charlie Kirk, I mean, you know, I can see that he was a very active presence on the internet where Dick Cheney wasn't, but neither was the insurance guy. So again, you know, I'm just trying to, right now, just trying to solve the puzzle, you know, what has changed so that conversation has become so different?
Yeah, and I don't follow, I'm not on Twitter much, so I don't really follow most of that. I would assume that there was some celebration in the wake of the death of Dick Cheney, just given how people felt about him, you know, 15 years ago, gosh, 20 years ago, I'm assuming that there was some of that. Yeah, I think you're right, though. He's not a public presence today the way that he would have been in 2008. Certainly not the way that Charlie Kirk was. Maybe another point of parallel here. How are people reacting to the wiping out of the entire leadership class of the government of Iran? Right? Is that
right? Right.
And again, different circumstances, right? I'm not trying to draw a parallel between Dick Cheney or I also can't remember the CEO's name of the insurance company, or Jesse Jackson and the government of Iran. There are different things going on there, but it's still human beings who have died or been killed. How should we respond in those circumstances? Well, increasingly, you're right, the answer is celebrate. And yeah, why one and not the other? Again, that's a challenging question, which isn't an answer. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's all right. That's all right. Now, one thing that I also wanted to run past you, and this is a question, you know, about social conditions. I mean, you know, it strikes me that, you know, one objection to, you know, my own concern might be that, okay, you know, this is just a change without moral gravity, that, you know, this is not something where, you know, the society has become more wicked. It's not a change where the society has become more righteous. It is merely a difference without any kind of moral valence. My own, you know, response to that would be that, you know, to respect the dead is something that inherently has moral gravity, right? That's why I wanted to start with Homer. And of course, we could have gone to Sophocles and other kinds of figures. You know, is that something that is geographically specific? Is that something that, you know, is a Christian inheritance? You know, is that a mere difference, or is that, in your view, a difference that actually has some moral import to it?
Well, again, I think there's obviously a difference that matters. If nothing else, it's yet another place where we've lost that inner check where 20, 30 years ago, you and I would have said, well, maybe I shouldn't say this thing publicly. Maybe I think it, but I'm going to exercise some self-restraint and not say it, in part because there might be social consequences for doing so. That's just now totally out the window. Mm-hmm. Now it's whatever pops into my head is going on to Twitter, is going on to Truth Social or Blue Sky or whatever, right? That's going to happen.
Sure.
And I think I'm going to jump down your outline a little bit. I think it's one thing. You could say, well, there have always been polarizing figures, and there have always been people saying, I'm glad they're dead, right? I haven't gone back and looked this up. I'm sure there was something in the New York Times after Richard Nixon died with some columnist saying, yeah, good riddance, right? I'm sure that happened.
Sure.
That's one thing. If it's Dick Cheney, if it's Richard Nixon, if it's Jesse Jackson, there are entire segments of the American population who hate those people. It's another thing entirely when it's a fairly innocuous person, like, say, Rob Reiner, right? Someone who is either beloved or people just don't know who he is, or you know who he is, but you kind of don't like him, but you don't care that much. Well, all of a sudden, even Rob Reiner is this polarizing figure in the wake of his death. That's where I think we have to say, wait a second. There's
remind our listeners for a moment. I mean, the circumstances of the initial attack, because I get a sense that a lot of the post-mortem attacks on Rob Reiner were, for lack of a better term, copycats.
Oh, certainly. And I don't remember the exact word, but Rob Reiner died. And Trump went on Truth Social and immediately just blasted the guy. I don't remember the exact words that he used, but they were really horrific, to the point where many of Trump's evangelical supporters were saying, hey, wait a second. This is a bridge too far. Not that it actually cost him any support, because nothing costs him support. But
right.
There was some mild pushback from evangelical Roman Catholic supporters saying, you know, you ought not say that about people.
And especially not the Princess Bride guy.
Especially not the Princess Bride guy. So, and then, yeah, after that, there was the requisite defenses of Trump, because wasn't Reiner really awful also? But that did all start with the single Truth Social post. That, again, that feels a little different than people going after Charlie Kirk or going after Dick Cheney or going after Jesse Jackson, because whatever his political opinions were, and I'm sure being in Hollywood, I'm sure he was on the left, he wasn't a polarizing figure in life. It's not like anybody says, oh, I hate the Princess Bride because it's, you know, such a left-wing hippie movie, or it's such a, you know, fascist movie or whatever. No, nobody's saying that. And then he dies, and all of a sudden we're fighting over him in the wake of his death.
Right, right. But to loop back to Jesse Jackson for a moment, like I said, the oddity with that one, and this really was one of those moments where I thought, oh my goodness, I mean, you know, I've been trying to deny this for, you know, 9 years now, but I mean, it's kind of undeniable now, because I was expecting a flood of right-wing vitriol against Jesse Jackson, but Donald Trump got out ahead of it, wrote this Truth Social post in praise of Jesse Jackson, and at least in my circles, there was almost no post-mortem commentary, much less post-mortem attacks on Jesse Jackson. Is that idiosyncratic to my circles, or, I mean, did you get any kind of response to, you know, the life and the career of Jesse Jackson after he died?
Yeah, the sort of traditional conservatives, for whatever few of those are left, right? The old William F. Buckley style conservatives were not rejoicing, because they are also in that older mode of, you know, you don't totally trash someone after they're dead, but there were definitely a National Review ran a blurb saying, yeah, well, we weren't super excited about him when he's alive, but we wish his family and such well. I mean, again, the very, very much the old style of that. But there was also the, we did not care for his politics and did not care for him. I did see that coming from that wing, where you would expect it to come from on the American right. Nothing on the style of Trump and Rob Reiner. Nothing in the style of Trump and Robert Mueller. But what you would expect to have seen 30 years ago had Jesse Jackson died then instead of now. So yeah, I saw it, but you're right, it was muted, I think, with the rest of the right because of Trump's Truth Social post. And that's, you know, that's just Trump being a troll, right? Trolling his own side. Even in the same way that if Zora Mondami were to die tomorrow, we'd see something very similar come from Trump, right? What a great guy. Sorry he's gone, et cetera, et cetera. Why? Well, because that's what he does. He's an agent of chaos, and whatever he can do to stir up chaos is what he's going to do.
I'm not going to deny that he's an agent of chaos. The other reason that I would expect that about Mamdani is because Mamdani has visited Trump in the White House and treated him with public respect.
Sure.
And I wonder if that's part of the Jesse Jackson factor, too, is that even though, you know, at least for the most recent 12 years, they have been, you know, opposing forces in politics, you know, Jesse Jackson was inside of Trump's own personal circles.
That's entirely possible. I don't know the relationship there. Trump has his group of people that he likes personally, and maybe Jackson was just one of those.
Fair enough. Yeah, I feel like I heard that on the news. And again, listeners, I'm sorry, I should have done some more research into this. But like I said, you know, mainly it was just a philosophical question that, you know, is occurring to me. So I do want to backtrack again to Robert Mueller, because this one, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me that Donald Trump went after him. What doesn't make as much sense to me is that, you know, you didn't have a whole lot of copycat the way that, or at least I didn't see, I'll put it that way, a whole bunch of copycat the way that I saw with Rob Reiner. Now, that might just have been that I was busy at that time and I wasn't online as much, but I feel like there were a lot of people bending over backwards to justify the attacks on Rob Reiner. Whereas with Bob Mueller, for whatever reason, you know, people just didn't have as much energy for that as they did for Rob Reiner. Was I just away from the internet more that week?
I mean, I saw some attacks on Mueller, but I think part of it is that Mueller's death was not, I want to make sure I say this carefully, it was not the same level of event as Rob Reiner's death. Robert Mueller did not make the Princess
True
Bride.
Enough.
He did not. He did not define, you know, a generation of moviegoers the same way that Rob Reiner did. And Robert Mueller didn't have a massive, you know, outpouring, a massive number of people who were saddened by his loss in the same way that Rob Reiner did. In fact, I think I would be comfortable saying if he hadn't been picked as the special investigator, as the independent counsel looking into the Trump campaign, nobody would know who he was. Not that he wasn't an important figure. He basically defined the war on terror on the judicial side of things. I mean, he's a very important figure in terms of the bureaucracy, but none of us know who the important figures in the bureaucracy are, right? They just sort of fly under the radar because he had this moment where he was doing this thing that ended up really going nowhere and revealing nothing. His name was out there, and that's why we even noticed that he died. That's not true.
No, that makes some sense, because that does make sense, because you're right. I mean, I am aware of, you know, Bob Mueller's work during the George W. Bush administration, but I heard about it during Russiagate. So that actually makes a fair bit of sense. So let me ask you this, Coyle. I mean, you know, one of the things that we often hear about, and I'm going a little bit off the outline here, but it's something that occurred to me as we were talking. One of the things that we often hear about is that, you know, the late 20th century is an unusual moment in American history because political nastiness actually diminished in a way from what was the norm during the 18th and 19th centuries. And people always go back to the election of 1800, you know, one candidate calling the other one a mulatto, and, you know, one calling the other one, you know, terrible things. And that's kind of what I wonder. I mean, you know, you are more read in the history of these things than I am. I mean, did it extend beyond the grave in the 18th and 19th centuries, or was that, you know, sort of classical restraint at the death of one's opponent something that, you know, held people back in the 18th and 19th centuries in ways that it doesn't hold back first century, even presidents?
Yeah, I do not know the answer to that, but I would guess that it was mostly characterized by restraint and not speaking ill of the dead, with a scattering of celebration of the, you know, that they are dead, just as it,
yeah, because
it has,
I mean,
been the, most,
you know,
times,
right? Because I mean, the phrase "burning in effigy" wasn't invented in the 21st century, but was that mainly reserved for people who were still alive, or did that also extend to people who had recently met their demise?
I just don't know. I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
Okay, no, that's all right. That's all right. No, like I said, I thought about these things sooner, I would have, you know, done some research on them, but they're occurring to me kind of as we roll along here. So, you know, now that, you know, we've talked about some of the oddities in these particular cases, I want to talk about some of the big picture things philosophically. So, you know, when we talk about what we aspire to, I mean, you know, is a return to that restraint something that, you know, American citizens should respond to? Let's start on that first. You know, is there a civic virtue in being restrained after the death of one's opponents? Is this something that, you know, probably elected officials won't say anything because elected officials have no spines, but, you know, people who are commentators, people who are writers and, you know, public figures of other sorts, could things get better if, you know, people spent some time and some energy trying to reestablish this as a norm?
I mean, in theory, things can always get better, but I'm not overly optimistic about it.
Right, but let me ask this. In what ways would changing this make things better?
Yeah, I mean, I think we unfortunately live in a time when "don't be a jerk" is both something that everyone needs to hear and something that no one will hear. So a bit of basic civil decency, even in just the baseline level of how we speak about each other on something dumb like Twitter, right? Even just that is more and more looking like an unattainable goal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not entirely sure how to navigate that, right? I'm not sure how do you tell people, hey, go on Twitter and don't trash others after they're dead, especially when what you're really saying is go on Twitter and say things that people will not like and follow you for.
Yeah.
I don't know how to do that, right? I don't know how to tell people to navigate social media in a way that works directly the opposite of the way social media works, if that makes sense.
In some circles, and here's why I say that, because, I mean, in some other situations, and again, part of it is the atomization of social life, that, you know, people have these very, very siloed circles of influence on, you know, on the internet. But, I mean, there are regions of the internet, you know, I mean, and of course, I mean, you know, people are very familiar with the phrase cancel culture. But I mean, you know, what I can say in praise of cancel culture, even though I don't say a whole lot in praise of cancel culture, is that it does have a moral force to it. Even if, you know, it is something that I dislike, and in most cases I do, I can point at that and say, all right, there are certain moral norms that are being enforced ruthlessly. And, you know, in fact, they are so ruthless that we call them cancel culture. Is that something that could be turned towards those who speak ill of the dead? Or, you know, would we, should I be careful for what I wish for?
I mean, right now it would be a 360 for, or a 180 for cancel culture, right? Because right now the enforcement is, if you are on the other side of the political aisle, one of your political enemy dies and you speak up in favor of them, you're going to get canceled by your own side, right? So you would have to get cancel culture to do, again, exactly the opposite of what it does. I don't see a path to make that happen. I don't see a path to change the culture. I don't see a path to convince the people who are doing this that they ought not to be. I don't know. You've asked me a question that I do not know the answer to, and that I do not see a way to do that. I hope there's an answer. I hope there's someone out there who's got a solution to it. I don't know what it is, and I don't know how to get there.
One thing that you said earlier might be the beginning of a path. I mean, you said that when people are in the room with you, then folks are less likely to do it. Now, you know, I brought up my high school students as one troubling place where, you know, that rule doesn't seem to have any force. But I mean, you know, and I also realize that, you know, we're venturing into very well traveled territory for us here. But I mean, you know, the removal of restraints online is something that people talk a very lot about. I mean, is it as straightforward as that? I mean, people who spend more time in proximity, would that sustained proximity bring back some of that restraint, do you think? And I'm not asking this as a trap. I really don't know. Sure. I'm trying to work this out.
I mean, I think it does. I think it would, and I think it does. And I think there are good examples of that kind of across the spectrum. I'm reading a book right now on racial justice, which is mostly not a great book, but that is one of the places where it talks about, hey, if you want to have better race relations, having people of different races live with each other and actually have to talk to each other and interact with each other in the physical world is one of the things that you can do for it. Yeah, I think that principle translates across, you know, a wide spectrum of challenges, including this one. The problem that you're going to run into is, yeah, that will work very well for a very small number of people. It won't change the culture or the society, right? It'll 10 people out of every 100,000 to be slightly less of a jerk. And some of us definitely need that, right? Some of us definitely need that, but It's not gonna shift anyone's usage of social media. It's not gonna change Twitter. It's not gonna change Facebook. It's not gonna change anything out there. It's just going to help out that small number of people. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to help out a small number of people. I think that's a great thing to do. But we're talking about big social trends. What's going to turn the whole ship? It's not gonna be that. Just the numbers are against that.
Well, and I mean, it is something that has to be sustained. Sustained proximity is a little bit too clinical, but I'm going to start there because, you know, that's one of the phenomena that I've definitely noticed is that even when I try to encourage those kinds of disciplines, right, with people that I teach, you know, it could be, you know, as soon as, you know, a year and a half later, you know, when I haven't been around them for a spell, that, you know, they will be behaving atrociously online. So, I mean, I hate when conversations turn down this alley because I just keep thinking, okay, you know, any kind of, you know, influence that, you know, you can exert in person evaporates once you're not in person.
It certainly does. And habits that you learn are lost. I mean, again, even assuming best case scenario, right, best possible case scenario, and you've got one person who agrees to behave in a more decent manner and who manages to convince 10 other people to do so, it's still just a drop in the well, right? It's still just a drop in the well. And I think a good parallel here, a decade ago, we were talking about something like the Benedict option, right? Which I still think is a really interesting option. I still think it's a really intriguing discussion to have. still love exposing students to it. I don't think that it is the solution to our social ills. I think it is a way for a very small community to be a generally healthy community. It's not going to fix society.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this,
I was saying, no, that said, fix a community, right? Fixing a community is a great thing to do, but we shouldn't pretend that it's going to do anything other than that.
Right, right. And here's what that kind of leads my thinking to is, and once again, I need to just have an index of, you know, articles that I refer to frequently because I always want to talk about them, but I never can remember their titles. But the article from, again, maybe 10 years ago that talked about the exhausted middle, you know, the statistical, you know, study that was done that shows that, you know, the very online, very partisan people, you know, constitute maybe, you know, 20% of the, you know, voting age electorate, and that there is this group of, you know, somewhere between 70 and 80% that are just exhausted by all of the hyper partisans on the left and the right. I mean, are those exhausted people? Do you think that, you know, first of all, do you think they still exist 10 years later? And second of all, do you think that, you know, they would be eager for a kind of appeal to more of a local community-based decency?
Well, I'd say of the 20% of non-exhausted, angry online people, you got to remember at least half of those are Russian bots. So even that number is a little off.
Right. Carry on.
Yeah, I'm skeptical of that also, because I think what tends to happen, and maybe this is me being the elderly cynic here, but I think what tends to happen is the exhausted middle gets online and just picks a side and runs with it. I think they might still be the exhausted middle, but they when they do get involved, it has not often been the case that they are a moderating influence. And thinking from a political perspective, of course, they're voting Republican or Democrat, right? The exhausted middle is not flocking to the third party.
Right.
They're still voting for the people that are in power. So I would not look to the exhausted middle as a solution.
Not a solution, but perhaps an audience is what I was trying to get at. You know,
yes.
That's one of those things I have started to distinguish between election day politics and everyday politics, for lack of a better term, because, you know, election day politics, yeah, I mean, I've come to realize that, you know, 96% of people who actually show up on election day are going to vote Democrat, Republican. And honestly, you know, as far as the people who run campaigns, that's all they're concerned about. It is the entertainment industry that has grown up parallel to it that wants people to be angry at the other side every day of every year, that I'm more concerned about kind of on a spiritual level. And, you know, I guess this is as good a segue as any to kind of turn towards that theological, spiritual side of things. You know, I am perfectly happy for people to go out on election day, vote, and then come home and forget about it. What I get concerned about is an entertainment industry that's trying to sell advertisements that, you know, wants people never to forget about it, and in fact to be angry every day of their lives. I mean, that strikes me as a spiritual poison at the very least. You know, I mean, I don't think it's going to break out into civil war. I know that that's sometimes something people, you know, speculate about online. But, you know, I mean, people who don't get up from their keyboards don't start wars, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying, although I would be hesitant to separate the political from the entertainment anymore. I think that's all just one big group of people.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
It does, but I mean, if there are, you know, I mean, and let's be, you know, cautious about it and say that there's, you know, 40% of voting age citizens who are just tired of all the nonsense. I mean, those people, you know, assuming that they still show up to vote, are tired of the nonsense the rest of the time. I mean, are those people still around, or?
Well, those people show up and vote for the person who says, aren't you tired of the nonsense, right? The other side is where the nonsense is. So I'm sick and tired of the nonsense. I'm angry at the nonsense too. So let's drain the swamp, or let's break the 1%, or let's build back better, or let's whatever, right?
Yeah.
It becomes just another lever for the entertainment /political industry to use to wedge one side against the other, because even that 40% is tired in different ways that become the partisan divide.
Okay.
So,
all right. Yeah.
Yeah. I know.
Sense.
I'm sorry.
That makes some sense.
No, that doesn't answer your theological question.
But I kind of turn towards American citizens first. So, I mean, you know, Let's turn theological for a few minutes. I mean, you know, I've told you before. Oh, and by the way, listeners, I haven't told you all this. And actually, Coyle, I might not have told you this either, and I apologize if I haven't. But I was ordained as a Disciples of Christ minister in March 2026. So, you know, now I can actually say, you know, as a preacher. But, you know, I mean, as a preacher, you know, one of the things that I definitely try to keep my ears open for and my eyes open for is people who are captured by this perpetual anger industry. Because that really is something that I see as a spiritual problem. And, you know, I mean, those are the kinds of folks that, you know, I do try to get into, you know, person-to-person conversations with people who differ at the very least, even if they don't differ on that partisan level. So, I mean, you know, as far as that is concerned, you know, I mean, obviously I'm not pastor to these high school students that I teach. So I'm not going to jump in, you know, to their conversation on that level. But, I mean, you know, within the parish, within the congregation, within the local worshiping community, you know, I mean, as far as you can see, Coyle, I mean, is that a worthwhile struggle to enter into? Or, you know, am I making much of something that shouldn't be much?
100% a useful struggle to enter into, right? We're not going to solve the meta problem at the American level, or the international level, or whatever sort of super level you wanna draw. Locally and certainly in congregations, absolutely, right? We as Christians should be identifying sin, should be repenting of sin, should be pursuing holiness, wherever we see it, online, in our own hearts, in public, in our churches. I mean, sort of across the boards. That is one of the places where there is room for optimism, and that is one of the places where we should be, whether we are or not, we should be actively resisting those worst temptations in ourselves. We should be exercising the self-restraint and the check. And the way to do that is by being in those local communities, is by being a member of a healthy local church where the preaching from the pulpit is, hey, gospel matters first, right? The gospel is the thing that binds all of us together, not what party you vote for, not what what political organization you support, not what TV news channel you watch most often. What matters is that we are all united around the incarnate, crucified, and resurrected Christ, right? That's got to be the point number one. And if you forget that, and if you are not fellowshipping with that as the middle, then you're already sinning and have something to repent of. So there is room for hope there, but also kind of hopefully by definition, I realize in the post-COVID era, there are places where this isn't true, but hopefully church is one of the places where we still see each other face to face. Right, where there does have to be some kind of social civility in place, just by virtue of all of us being in a room together for an hour on Sunday morning and participating in the same activities for an hour on Sunday morning. So there is still some of that going on, where people are receiving the kind of training that we should be undergoing for all of life. Does that make sense?
Well, that makes good sense. And you know, that's one of those interesting places where. And again, I honestly think part of it just might be that I'm just not that good at math. But, you know, I do think about, you know, things that, you know, are going to have some kind of influence at that local community level. But then, you know, I mean, I have, just like you said, I have trouble not just translating it into influence on that larger picture, but even trying to figure out, you know, how a community of a few hundred people relates to a, you know, viewership of a few million people. Right. And again, I'm inclined to say that, you know, even though, you know, 50 million people vote for the Democrat and, you know, 49.8 million people vote for the Republican every time it comes around, I don't think of those 50 million person voting blocks as even as media ecosystems the way I would have 40 years ago, much less communities.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with that. Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I don't know that they are a community other than a community of outrage, a community of kind of a momentary, this thing is trending right now. But again, as a church, our focus would be more on the micro, on the smaller level anyway, if I'm following what you're saying.
Well, so yeah, again, keep going.
I would say, again, we can't fix the nation, but we can we can work in the local church.
Right, right. And, you know, that witness, and I think this is where, you know, I'm trying to think about that. That witness is going to be different from the recent, you know, connotation of the noun influence, right? It's not going to be something that can really reach millions of people at the level of complexity that it needs to. And this is something that I've been thinking about a lot, and this might have been something as well that kind of drove me towards this conversation, Coyle, is that, you know, this conversation, I mean, you know, I very intentionally started it with Homer and Sophocles because, you know, those stories have some complexity to them. And in fact, you know, when you started to address them, you addressed a side of it that I hadn't even addressed yet. And, you know, one of the things about the outrage entertainment industry is that it is allergic to complexity. And in fact, it regards complexity as a kind of treason in some cases.
Very much so.
If you are, you know, trying to get us to, you know, think for more than an instant about something before we react in our outrage, what you're doing is you are taking away from the urgency of the moment.
The idea of, I like that way of putting it, right? Complexity is too much for Twitter. It's what is, right? Someone has died. So to go back to the sort of original topic, someone has died Your response is of necessity limited to whatever the limits are these days, 120 characters or 240 characters or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So you can be happy or sad, but you can't be both, right? You can't say these are the good things this person did. These are the bad things this person did. And if you try to do that, people are going to stop listening. People are going to listen until they disagree and then go find someone they agree with because... Again, complexity is really not possible, even though we live in a much more complex world than we've ever lived in before, which, how to fix that problem, yet again, I don't know. There's been a lot of I don't know this episode.
Well, I mean, I think you've put your finger on one answer to it, and the answer is locally, right? In places where real conversation can occur. You know, a conversation is not one person talking to 3 million people. A conversation is, you know, 8 or 10 people exchanging ideas, or even better, 2 or 3 people, right? So, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, you got your finger on that, you know, one of the things that I would encourage, you know, Christians to think about is, you know, is reducing the amount of energy and reducing the amount of resources that we put into mass communication in general. And, you know, put those resources into inviting people into places and moments where actual conversation can happen. Because, you know, one of my own fears, Coyle, and we'll kind of start heading for the door after this because I realize that, you know, you got places to be and people to see. But one of my fears is that when I say, you know, we need greater complexity, people think, well, of course, you know, he's an ex-professor. You know, he wants everyone to go to grad school and, you know, write 70-page master's theses. You know, and I like people who write 70-page master's theses, but... What I'm more interested in is people getting involved in conversations where we can explore that complexity in a more momentary way rather than in an academic publication context.
Yeah, and I don't particularly want people to go to grad school, so there's that too. some of the students, former students I'm most proud of are morticians. I have one who's an employee at a nail factory. I mean, hey, go get a real job. Which, of course, you can still deal with complexity, even if you're, in some ways, you might be more equipped to deal with it, because rather than hyper-focusing on one specific academic topic, well, now you have to deal with kind of all of the complexity that the real world throws at you. At some point, we should get some of my former students on who are morticians. They've got great stories about all of the different religious traditions that they have to try to navigate. Because they're the one mortician in this small town with so we could do some of that. But yeah, I think you're right though. I think it is both easier to deal with complexity in a small intimate setting, and it's easier may not be the right word, but it is more likely that the human element won't be forgotten. And again, I'll default to this book on racial justice that I'm reading. It would be, in some ways, easy for you and I to have a conversation about race, although we're probably not going to do it because neither of us wants to get canceled. We could have that conversation, but it would also be better to have a larger group of people with a, you know, some kind of representative minorities included so that we can see the things that I say have real world consequences that I would not have thought of by myself, that maybe I'm not even capable of thinking of because of my background, because of who I am. It's just not on my radar, and we need those other voices to come along and speak into the circumstance. And you get that with smaller conversations in a way that you don't get with a massive platform.
I think that's a good place to wrap things up, Coyle. So listeners, thank you for listening in and for downloading. Like I said, we're going to start, you know, trying to keep at least an episode a month pace. I know that sometime in June, I'm going to put together some notes for an episode on the Declaration of Independence, because, you know, what better time than, you know, the summer of 2026 to talk about the Declaration of Independence as a document, as an argument, as a cultural artifact. It seems like a good idea to me. What do you think, Coyle?
Are we going to be for it or against it? Because that may affect what I think about it.
Let's read it first, and then we can decide.
I'm Team Declaration of Independence, so I, as long as we're for it, I think I'm okay. Yeah, sounds like a good idea.
I think we'll be all right then.
All right.
All right, listeners, so tell your friends, tell people online, but only in a small circle, but tell people that we are back. Thank you so much for sticking with us here at the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Of course, City of Man is a product of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. We do our own editing these days, and you can find us at christianhumanist.org. That's where we will announce new episodes. You'll also be able to find announcements for episodes of Christian Humanist Profiles. And we're getting this thing started back up, guys. We're getting the band back together. So until next time, thank you for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high